Radio City, John Grayson, Rob Ross with you once again. And boy, once again, we have absolutely no shortage of things to talk over in the world. Rob Ross, how's everything by you?
Everything's really good. You know, as you and I have talked about on many occasions, the Saturday before Thanksgiving is my annual trek to Trader Joe's to do the one-stop shop. And yet again yesterday, everything was gained in less than 45 minutes. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. So I am armed and prepared for this Thursday's feast.
Well done.
But I think we should start off by yet again explaining that this is episode 39 point, version 2.0, because due to a serious technological malfunction, we lost the improvised episode 38, which we re-recorded this past week. And along with that was lost to episode number 39, which we had done last Sunday. So here we are again attempting to do this, albeit now almost 2 weeks later with a great deal more material and a lot more, I think, linear connections between what we were talking about then going into this past week.
Right, and it also means that there will be three episodes of Radio City that will drop over the next 7 days, so there will be plenty out there for everybody to listen into, but there have been some things that have happened just over the last couple of days, and we wanted to start off with a few of these and mention the fact that we've once again unfortunately had some sad goodbyes that we have to issue here on the show, not the least of which was the guy who, in my mind, set the tone, set the template for heavy metal tone as the rhythm guitarist for AC/DC, Malcolm Young, founding member, of course, along with Angus, of that band. And he had been in failing health for a very long time, but it gives us the opportunity to talk about exactly what that guy meant, because he never seemed to mind standing in the background while Angus Young did these amazing guitar licks, and while first Bon Scott and then Brian Johnson later on, you know, belted out these amazing vocals, and yet he was the framework of that band. I mean, without Malcolm there, it's not AC/DC.
What can I say to expound upon that further, except you're absolutely correct. And I am first and foremost hopeful that with Malcolm gone, they're going to just retire the name once and for all, because it makes zero sense. At this stage, the only one left is Angus, because bassist Cliff Williams retired.
Yep.
Drummer Phil Rudd was in very serious trouble with the law in Australia, so he's out of the band. Brian Johnson left the band maybe 2 years ago at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And so without Malcolm and Angus, there's no AC/DC. You know, Malcolm Young was not only, in my mind, and agreeably in the minds of so many other well-known, well-thought-out, well-schooled writers, etc., he was possibly the greatest, quote, rhythm guitarist that's ever walked the planet.
Yeah.
His was the sound of AC/DC, because it was his crunch that gave AC/DC that sound. You know, you put Angus's fills over it, that's another story entirely, but it was his foundation that made it AC/DC, and to me, he was the leader of that band. He was the rock, steady, actually, I think, calming influence in that group, and I think we were very lucky to have witnessed a nice, lengthy career from what I think is a greatly underappreciated and almost criminally overlooked true rock legend in the biggest letters possible.
Yeah.
I think Malcolm Young was more of a legend than Angus, because Angus is just another flashy lead guitarist. They all are.
Right. Right. And I think that, yeah, that's where you really separate the people who know their stuff, because it's one thing to worship at the altar of Angus Young. And I think, you know, as far as his talent is concerned, it's unparalleled, but when you talk to the people who really know their stuff about music, it's Malcolm that they're in awe of. And, you know, there's another thing I want to skew off into here for a second, because for the longest time, we didn't know what it was that Malcolm was dealing with. They just said serious health issues. He's got to retire from the road. And this is going back 2 years ago. So everybody assumes when it's something like that, that it's cancer. And in this case, what we found out over these last couple of days is that he was suffering from dementia. And we talked about this some when Bowie died, and with a couple of the other announcements where there may have been rumblings, but nobody really knew anything. And then all of a sudden, we just got an announcement that he had died. And the speculation aside, I think that it's one of those times when it really does underscore why, even after living a very public life, people like Malcolm Young want their privacy as they're facing the end of life. And I think that's totally valid. We don't need to know what's going on while they're going through it, because it's not like we're going to be in the hospital making decisions for them.
Well, I remember when the announcement came that he was retiring from the road, because it was sudden, and because the announcement was equally sudden,
yep.
And he did say dementia. And they gave a background on how he had started to forget a lot of the songs, et cetera, and then it turned into something more serious than just forgetting a song that you hadn't played in a while. The thing is, it's a very cruel disease to watch, or affliction. I don't think I could call it a disease per se, because there's always some kind of alignment with something else that
right.
leads to the ultimate ending. And my father, one of the things that helped aid his earlier than wanted demise was Alzheimer's and dementia. So when you watch something like that happen, I think the person deserves all the privacy and dignity affordable. That's first and foremost. Second of all, I know people want to know the details of when a celebrity or a beloved musician, actor, whatever is in the last stages of life, but does it really matter? The fact is they're gone. They've suffered with something and they're gone. And all we should be doing is just celebrating a great musician, a great songwriter, because people forget he was the contributing songwriter
right.
too. That's the other thing that makes him so crucial to the AC/DC story on every level. And just be thankful that we had him and we've got the records and the memories if we've seen AC/DC, which I have, with both Bon Scott and with Brian Johnson, and just revel in that fact. And at the same time, I think it brings us to another person who has, the announcement has not been officially made yet that he is gone, but David Cassidy is also at the last stages of his life, it seems, and he too has in fact been suffering from dementia, which he was very forthcoming about. And all I can say is this, false rumors have been spreading already this morning that he had indeed passed through some very poor reportage. And I've actually had conflicts, written and otherwise, with a few friends on Facebook saying he's not passed. And you shouldn't be reporting this as such.
Right.
I think we should have learned a lesson from the Tom Petty episode. But, check your facts. It takes a millisecond to look through all the news wires, the legitimate news wires that are out there.
Right.
It's that simple.
And not to mention, I just don't understand the point of it. I mean, we've got to report it first. Why? I mean, we're all going to be, when we get there, we're all going to be dead for a very long time. I don't think that 15 or 20 minutes is going to make that much difference.
And just out of respect, simple respect.
Right.
If you're going to, put someone on that pedestal, whether they like it or not, you should at least have enough respect to show them that dignity that they're accorded at this point, and their families, because their families are going through hell.
Right. And their families didn't ask for a public life in most cases. So, on that subject though, there is one other celebrity death that has been confirmed, and it's another unfortunate one. And I have to admit, as a kid, I was not a country music fan at all, but there were names that I knew. And I grew a great appreciation for Johnny Cash through my dad, and there were a few others. And one of the ones that used to pop up from time to time was Mel Tillis. And I remember him mostly for the commercials that were on TV when I was a kid. Was he pitching life insurance or something like that? And it was just funny because here was a guy who had this stutter, this pronounced stutter that he even made sort of a character out of, wasn't ashamed of it, and shouldn't have been. It's just that at the time, that was something that was hard for a lot of people to deal with. So here's this guy who unabashedly, I don't care what you think of me, I'm going to come out and do these commercials, and yet was able to sing these brilliant songs. He was another voice that was undeniable, but the term that always struck me with Mel Tillis was gentleman. He was like that embodiment of the country gent,
Completely agreed yet again. You know, I listened to a lot of country music as a child because as we've talked about before, WHN Radio in New York switched to a country format in 1971 or 2, and that was the station that my mother had listened to almost religiously, and she didn't tune out. She stayed with it. So that was where I got my introduction to the world of country music. And yeah, Mel Tillis was one of the giants. You know, you always remembered him and always would say his name is Mel.
But right.
The thing is that you are completely correct. He made a character of it because he had, in fact, controlled the stutter. It was just something that became his stock in trade.
Right.
But when you heard him sing, he had such a rich, warm, powerful, emotive voice. He had a beautiful singing voice, and he could send chills down your spine, whether it was a love song or if it was one of those, you know, my ma got out of jail and I'm going to go pick her up in my pickup truck with my dog and I got my gun and we're going to the train, you know, because that's your standard country song
right there.
And he was also a really wonderful comedic actor, too. You know, he would do these little cameos and movies and TV shows, and Mel Tillis was a joy. It's that simple.
Yeah.
And yeah, you hit it right on the head. Country gentleman, the personification of it, without a doubt.
Gone at age 85, and again, more sad news, unfortunately, from the music world this week, but well-deserving of the respect that is afforded to a lot of people at this time. So to all of their families and to all of their friends, our heartfelt sympathies at this point. There are a couple of other things going on, though, and we had talked about this right on the heels of it happening, but now we've got the added, because we've had to re-record this, we've got the added perspective that about a week's worth has given us following the elections that saw a turning of the tide, depending on who you listen to, I guess. That's the hope for Democrats, is that the tide has turned because of a reaction to Donald Trump's complete and total ineptitude and lack of respect for the office of president. But maybe that's reading a little bit too much into the governor's races in New Jersey and Virginia and several other races around the country that were decided a week ago Tuesday. So now that we've had the chance for all of this to kind of settle in, what are you thinking?
Well, let me just start with the fact that I'm disgusted that New York City couldn't find someone, anyone, and I don't care what party, to go against Bill de Blasio, who is easily the worst mayor of New York in my lifetime.
Yep.
He's actually, I think, superseded the two worst that I thought of previously, Abe Beame and David Dinkins. Because here's a guy who's so mired in scandal, you know, the whole pay-to-play thing, which has come to light, and he's started to pick up impetus, the glad-handing in his administration, and the basic criminal element that works for him, such as his one of his spokespeople and the school's chancellor, etc., etc. But you and I have talked about de Blasio ad infinitum, and he's such a sore point with me. I tend to lose my sense of clarity and articulation and ability to report in a fair manner simply because of my dislike for him, so the less said the better. As far as New Jersey's governorship goes, I know Phil Murphy. I've had the honor and pleasure of meeting him when he was just back in the United States from having been the ambassador to Germany. And I could not have met a lovelier, kinder, more humble human being. You know, here's somebody who said, please don't call me ambassador, even though you're supposed to address someone even if they're no longer in the position.
Right, as their current job title, yeah.
Right, because he's just that kind of person. He and his family are wonderful people. His wife, Tammy, is a lovely human being. My hope for New Jersey is because they've had such a string of, I'm going to just call it disappointments in the governorship, that this is the one that indeed does turn the tide, because when you go back and you think of how horrible Jim McGreevy was, and Christine Whitman, John Corzine, and of course Chris Christie, and it's both parties. Both parties have just shown incredible, it's like you get them into office and the criminal element comes to the fore yet again. None of them have been scandal free. They've all been plagued by something. And the hope is that, you know, Phil Murphy can indeed turn this around, because New Jersey is sinking fast. The whole thing in Virginia, you know, I know it's a selling point, but I really could not care less. about them electing a transgender person to an office. All I care about as far as anybody being elected is, are you capable? Can you do the job? Do you know what the hell you're doing?
Right.
Are you in over your head? We'll see. You know, the thing about all of this glad-handing and self-congratulatory bullshit and patting themselves on the collective back is that the Democrats can celebrate all they want. Get to fucking work.
Yeah, right.
This is why we've been in the state that we've been in for so long. And I'm not talking about under Donald Trump's presidency. I'm talking about even going into the Obama years. You know, let's go back to when both houses, let alone the White House, were under the Democratic rule. They did nothing. And as a subsequent result, they lost it. And they haven't been able to gain it back. Enough with your bravo to us kind of thing. As I've said before on the show, the Democrats right now, their stock in trade is simply to point a finger of blame, tell you who to be afraid of and who to be angry about, but never shoulder any of the responsibility for what they have not done.
Right.
The thing that they tend to do, especially in a city like New York, is make life much harder for us because they raise taxes and expect people like me, the middle class, to carry the weight, which has got to stop.
Yeah. It's not enough to point at the other guy, as you were saying, and say, at least I'm not that asshole. That's not good enough. That's not a reason to vote for somebody. And all it leaves people to wonder is, okay, what kind of asshole are you? And that I think is the real danger in this, especially looking forward, because what I had predicted didn't come true. I thought that Alabama being Alabama, when this shit started to hit the fan with Roy Moore, that his numbers would actually go up. And I think we've seen a solidifying of the support for Roy Moore, but the attrition that has happened from the people that were out on the edges are costing him numbers. And the funny thing about it is it's not even that. In analyzing the reason why he's now 8 points down in this race, as opposed to being 11 points up, which he was a couple of weeks ago, is because there are new people who are putting themselves into the category of likely voters. Overwhelmingly, they are women. In this race specifically, over the last couple of weeks, overwhelmingly they're women, and overwhelmingly they're calling themselves likely voters now because they are going to go to the polls and vote against Roy Moore. Here's the danger in that. Off of wins in Virginia and New Jersey and potentially a win, a Democratic win in the Senate in fucking Alabama, which would be unfathomable in any other circumstance, is complacency. That the Democrats will then look ahead to November of 2018 and say, we got it knocked. We don't even have to work anymore. We'll just depend on Donald Trump to continue bumblefucking his way through the office, and he'll make it easy, and we'll win every race that we're a part of come next November. Think that way, become that kind of overconfident, continue to do absolutely nothing, and you will get your ass handed to you.
Well, there's something else about the Roy Moore thing, and that is, now that Gloria Allred has shown up with yet another quote-unquote accuser, that takes away, as far as I'm concerned, the credibility of the story that she's putting forth.
Uh-huh.
I'm not arguing or disputing anything that's been said before, but Gloria Allred could shill for anyone, and she is, to me, one of the most heinous human beings out there. She's like Johnny Cochran. She's like the guys who were involved in the Tawana Brawley case in New York.
Right.
Another ambulance-chasing piece of shit, and a perfect reminder of why people hate, and I'm using that word very nicely, hate lawyers.
Exactly, and she's earned the reputation over and over and over again. And, I mean, as if it wasn't bad enough that she's an attorney, she's also a radio talk show host, so screw those guys. That's right. Now, with the Roy Moore thing, there was a connection, I guess, tenuous as it may be, to another story that started floating around on the internet this week. And I checked it out, and believe it or not, even though it was a story that was floating around on Facebook, it actually is true. W Magazine, back in June, and I've never read a copy of W Magazine in my life, so.
Fabulous.
Is it? Okay, whatever. but they had, right there on the cover of this magazine, and again, this is the June edition of W Magazine. The headline was something to the effect of "Why TV is Sexy Again." And it had a list of actors and actresses, like Milo Ventimiglia from This Is Us was on the list, and a bunch of, you know, hot, youngish, you know, 20s to early 30s actresses and actors. And then one name that stood out, and the name that stood out was Millie Bobby Brown. Millie Bobby Brown is one of the stars of Stranger Things. She's the girl who plays Eleven on that show. And when they started shooting season one, she was 11. Season two this year, she is, and currently, she is 13 years old. Now, give me one good reason why a national magazine should have the name of a 13-year-old girl in a "Why TV is Sexy Again" masthead? Because that's sick.
You want me to go into the political angle of it, or do you want me to simply say as a human being who does not have children but certainly knows a couple of things about kids and the rearing of them? Very simply, there is absolutely no reason.
Yeah.
And it's unacceptable and inexcusable, and W should be called to the carpet for it, but I'm sure it won't, because you know who backs W Magazine.
That's not, that wasn't the one that JFK Jr. started, but no, that was George.
That was George. That was an actually pseudo-political magazine.
Okay. No, I know nothing about it, honestly.
It was a fashion magazine.
Okay.
It's just a fashion magazine. It's a mindless fashion magazine like all of them really
apparently,
are. It's,
yeah.
You know, a giant oversized magazine with, ooh, look at the pictures. That's all it is. And I find it reprehensible beyond words. But this is an industry, and we all know who runs that industry and directs it, and you know what their political stripes are, and they think it's okay, and it's unacceptable. So there's absolutely zero good reason to put a girl who's gone from the ages of 11 to 13 into an article that's considered sexy.
Yeah.
That's repugnant, and it's just unpardonable.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I hadn't even thought about it in that way until you just said that. But, you know, every actor or actress who's on that list of names is being treated by W Magazine like the proverbial slab of meat. But when you're an adult, okay, you can deal with that, and you can see that and go, okay, yeah, whatever. I mean, to the point of, this was also the week that People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive issue dropped, and it was that guy from The Voice, the country singer, whatever. So,
and Blake Shelton.
Yeah, right. And I think, yeah, Blake Shelton, and I think he can probably think of it the same way as, okay, who gives a shit? But who in their right mind says, well, if we're going to treat the adult actresses and actors like slabs of meat, yeah, we could do it to a 13-year-old girl too. I just, what editor saw that and went, yeah, run with it?
Well, you just said it in your own sentence. Who in their right mind?
Yeah, yeah.
Not someone in their right mind, it's someone in their, shall we say, left mind. So there's a double entendre in that.
Right.
But, you know, it also goes back to, you know, you can make the argument that people were justifiably, especially now that enough time has passed, were outraged when the now infamous Brooke Shields Calvin Klein jeans ad ran.
Yep.
So, you know, not just the print ad, but the commercial. I mean, Brooke Shields is a few months younger than I am. And now, granted, I really never had a thing for her until much later. I found she's one of those women who's just gotten incredibly more beautiful and stunning as she's gotten older.
Yeah.
I've gotten older, so I can appreciate her a lot more at our age. But, you know, when you're a 13-year-old boy and a 13-year-old girl appears in this ultra sexy, near pornographic commercial, you're not really getting the boner for another 13-year-old girl. You're getting, you know, you get them for your classmates, who you're going to sexually harass later on and then get, you know, called out 40 years later.
Right.
You know, you've got the hots for actresses who are on TV or movies, you know. That's how the normal mind works.
Yeah.
You know, and let's call the bullshit for what it is. So for them to now say that, oh, this is okay, bullshit. Fuck you.
Yeah.
You're a bunch of pimps, pushers, and dare I say, child pornographers yourself.
Right. Well, and the thing with Brooke Shields is even underscored more by the fact that when she was even younger than she was when she made that Calvin Klein ad, she did a movie with Susan Sarandon called Pretty Baby, and that was a huge controversy at the time. One of the Carradines was also in that. Keith, I think. Yeah, but it was a huge controversy because there was 11-year-old Brooke Shields naked on screen, and the difference is that that movie was about a girl who was forced into child prostitution. Stranger Things is a show about a group of kids. It's a sci-fi show. She's in the show. She's not posed as the, you know, as the hot one or anything like that. You know, the girl that these little kids are all after. She's just another character in a show. So whatever was going on to make that connection was going on simply in the minds of the people at W Magazine.
And damn them all to hell for it.
Now, on the subject of the social justice warriors at it again, and the folks in their left mind, you came up with this one. I had not heard of this controversy, but I just read a little bit about it, and it's cracked. Why are we going after Steve Martin?
Okay, first, I want to put the disclaimer forth that this is not a joke. This is not from The Onion, because most people who saw this thought, in fact, it was.
It sounds like it, yeah.
Right. There's some college called Reed College. I have no idea where this is located. So I'll start with that. But the headline is, students at Reed College are triggered by, and there's that fucking word, triggered by Steve Martin's King Tut skit from Saturday Night Live back in 1978.
And okay. And why are they? Oh, by the way, it's Oregon, which should add a little perspective to this.
Right. Okay. It is because, and I'm going to read you the snippet of the article because it's so well worded. It's something you and I would have written, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Comedian Steve Martin's rendition of King Tut is triggering social justice warriors at Reed College because they see it as a form of cultural appropriation. The song, originally performed on Saturday Night Live, actually criticizes the commercialization and trivialization of Egyptian history and presents a caricature of the treasures of Tutankhamun, traveling exhibit that toured seven United States cities from 1976 to 1979, which I indeed saw at the Museum of Natural History. However, the context to the SNL skit eludes students who are upset. They're now calling the song a form of blackface. Really?
Well,
no one here is sitting going out, la 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 la. Now you are going, mammy, mammy.
No.
Sorry, this is not blackface. All he's got is the funny hat. But this school full of these kids, it's apparently considered the most, quote, liberal college in America. I am of the hope and of the mindset that a meteorite, a sinkhole, a plague, something, you know, hell, even a mad bomber in this case.
Right.
Just goes to that fucking school and takes the entire place out and the constituency within.
Right. But here's, I mean, there are so many problems with this that are so obvious, but I'm going to go ahead and point them out anyway, because first of all, it can't be cultural appropriation because wasn't Tutankhamun born in Arizona? That's what Steve Martin said in the
fucking
song.
He owned a condo made of stone.
Right. But, you know, let's talk about the wording involved in this too, because this is not liberalism. Bullshit. This is not what liberalism is. It's not what liberalism ever was. And for them, I mean, you want to talk about appropriation. How about appropriating an entire political philosophy for the fact that you just want to find some bullshit to get your name in the paper with? So that's...
How about appropriation of a bunch of these fucking white kids who scream, I'm a liberal and I'm with you, and having dreadlocks?
Right. Exactly. I mean, that is no more representative of liberalism than those shithead white supremacists in Virginia were representative of conservatism. That's not what that is. It's a bunch of shitheads. They're out on so far out on the fringe and stamping their feet and holding their breath until they turn blue so that they can find something interesting to do.
Please hold your breath till you turn blue.
Yeah, right. And then keep holding it.
You know, these are, you know what, this is, you know what these fucking people really are? They're the biggest bunch of They're trying to justify their actions, but they're all a bunch of fucking racists, themselves,
yeah.
Anti-Semites, misogynists, you know. Listen, these are the same people who will marginalize and trivialize certain elements of the gay community that, you know, the older gay community fought and a lot of them died for.
Yeah.
Just to have basic rights. And I'm saying basic in very large, vehement letters. But they've negated those people for what they interpret unto themselves. So now, I know this is going to sound like I'm going off on a tangent here, but do you remember back in 1994 when Bob Mould caught a whirlwind of absolute shit in the now famous or infamous Spin magazine article where he quote-unquote officially came out, but the pull line that was used and splashed across every headline, then it didn't matter if it was in, you know, gay magazines or in just based, you know, your normal press. The quote that they used was, "I'm not a freak," because he was talking about, "I'm just a normal guy. I happen to be a homosexual. I'm not somebody who goes around in drag or wearing outlandish clothes or on a float or any of this stuff. I'm just a guy. I happen to be gay. So what? I'm not a freak." People took that and turned it around and made his life a living hell.
Yeah.
Those words are now unfortunately true. And they've taken people across different, you know, different cultural, sexual, whatever you want to call them, social backgrounds, and negated them to the background. So fuck every last one of these little shits.
Yeah.
They're not liberals, because a liberal person, by definition, is progressive and understanding, open-minded, and tries to be informed on every level.
Willing to listen. Yeah.
Yes. Listen without prejudice. Listen without a knee-jerk reaction. Listen, process, research, think, and then come back to the table with something viable. Otherwise, go fuck yourself, you little cunts.
Right, and when it comes to the, you know, the trigger words and all of this other crap, listen, when did your upset become my problem? I mean, you're upset. You're upset. You're triggered by a song that you'd never heard until one of your professors played it for you. I don't give a shit that you're upset. Fine, you're upset. You had an emotion. Congratulations. You're human. Barely.
That's very generous of you. Fuck them.
Yeah.
Every last one of them. Just, you know what? Fuck everyone who thinks like that, who feels like that, just all of you, because you don't belong in logical, reasonable, rational society. You and your mirror images on the right,
yeah,
can all fuck yourselves.
Exactly, all, yeah. And everybody has to feign outrage over everything. Oh, I'm outraged. No, you're not. No, you're not. Just relax and find something relevant to say.
You know what? Here's a reason you and I can automatically be outraged. One, we're both white. B, we're both middle-aged. C, you and I both have the quote, Zion blood in us, you know, but we're middle-aged white men. We're everybody's asshole.
Right, exactly. You know, and you know what?
Paul Bunyan here, because I got the biggest axe to grind.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm really not that upset about it. I'm fine. Life is good. So with that said, we've got, before we leave politics entirely, because we're going to get onto the fun stuff and get into some musical things, but there was one other thing that happened over the last couple of weeks. There have been two mass shootings, that one of which made national news, the other one of which should have, following what happened in Las Vegas. And the one that happened in Texas, the more that we're learning about this story and about how many people knew in both of these cases that these guys were dangerous and heavily armed, and something, I mean, every signal was there for somebody to step in both of these cases, and nobody did. And a whole bunch of people ended up dead because of it. I mean, in Texas, you had the Air Force, who knew that this guy was a serial abuser, that he was a dangerous and violent and prone to outburst against his own superiors, which was part of the reason they kicked him out. And what did they do when he got out? Wipe their hands. Okay, he's somebody else's fucking problem now. Didn't bother to report to anybody that maybe this isn't the guy you want to have a whole lot of guns.
The criminal negligence of the Air Force is just beyond shocking. I don't think I have anything more to say than that, because it's just shocking. It is so irresponsible about the way they handled this guy. And I think that's really all that needs to be said about it, because what he did was just so horrific, so planned out. The only thing that, if you want to call it, I don't want to say good, but the only thing that's, I guess, helpful is the fact that, as we know, the church would actually videotape every Sunday service.
Mm-hmm.
They, unfortunately, do in fact have the footage of him going in and methodically shooting everyone in the head. So they know the exact pattern, how this was done. It's not going to do anything since he's dead, so they can't really convict him of anything.
Right.
But the fact is that at least they know it's just another tragedy. Now, the other mass shooting, which got almost no headlines whatsoever, it was almost an afterthought. That, I think, speaks volumes in and of itself, because we're so desensitized and used to this now on a weekly basis that it was an afterthought.
Mm-hmm.
This shooting in California, you know, the guy, another one with a lengthy track record, couldn't get guns. He wasn't allowed to buy guns, but yet he had a well-stocked arsenal. He had stabbed his neighbor, I believe, and was awaiting trial for that.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken, you had told me that one of the stories was that his neighbors had all called the police and said, arrest him. He's out in the woods shooting off hundreds of rounds of bullets.
Yeah, on more than one occasion.
They came out there, knocked on his door. He wouldn't let them in, and so they couldn't arrest him?
Yeah, they just left.
Police go in with battering rams for drug busts.
Right.
Not even looking for guns. This one's a known psycho. He killed his wife and stuffed her body under the floorboards in their house. But the thing is that in this case, we heard next to nothing about it. It's almost like it didn't happen, really, because I never heard the guy's name, never saw a picture, don't know anything else except for those little snippets that either I picked up or that you and I had discussed. And what does that say about us as a society now? And what does that say about news agencies as well? What does it say about the government? Well, nothing that hasn't been said already to the point where we're all blue in the face from it. But we shouldn't just go, well, no one's going to listen anyway. We shouldn't become complacent about it. You should still be screaming from the rafters. But nobody better say thoughts and prayers. Fuck you and your thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, could not have put that one better. And yeah, you're right. As far as the press are concerned, and I don't know if there's a good way around this, because I think a lot of the reason why the California shooting didn't make the news, or at least didn't make national news much, is that it was in the middle of nowhere. It was in Northern California, north of San Francisco, and it was out where nobody lives. It wasn't, you know, it's flyover country. It wasn't in Los Angeles or Houston or Dallas or New York or Boston or Chicago. So it just kind of goes by the wayside. Nobody pays all that much attention. And it's hard to get reporters there. And I think what's driving this more than anything now is that, in addition to it being tough to get reporters out there, it's tough to get cameras there in a hurry while things are going on. So they just figure, it's not worth the effort, so it doesn't get covered, because if there's no pictures to show, then there's really no way to put it on Wolf Blitzer. And it's a terrible standard, because the story itself should drive whether or not it ends up on the national news, but it won't, because nobody's going to bother to send anybody out there.
But yet the shooting in Texas was also in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, but it was close enough. It was close enough to Houston, I think, right?
Isn't that disgusting?
No, San Antonio. I'm sorry.
Isn't that disgusting, though, that that's how they gauge it?
Right. Yeah.
So it's just, it's inexcusable.
Indeed.
Absolutely inexcusable.
Now, we do, as we said, we do have some things to go into that are much more fun to talk about. And I know you've been wanting to get into this one, and we did and then lost it, but there is, in terms of the big star camp, the overarching big star camp, there's a lot of new material out, both recorded music format and a new book as well that's semi-related. So let's start with the recorded material. What's out from Big Star?
Coming out in January, once again, from the wonderful people at Omnivore, who, it's always a labor of love with them. There's just no question about it, and thank God for that. Out in January will be live at Lafayette's Music Room. To give a little backstory, most people who know the Big Star history know that the band played at the Memphis Rock Writers Convention at Lafayette's Music Room in Memphis in May 73. That was the show that had a hand-picked audience that were flown in by John King, who worked for Ardent Records. You know, this was, we're talking about people like Richard Meltzer and Lester Bangs and a very young Cameron Crowe and John Tiven, who later went on to have a great career in music himself, and all these phenomenal, well-known, legendary writers were all there, the hand-picked, perfect audience for Big Star. But what most people don't know is that they played at the same venue 4 months earlier. Now, this was before, and by the way, it was always believed that that performance in front of the Rock Writers Convention was what spurred the, at that point, inactive Big Star to get back together and do another album, which became Radio City. That's a familiar sounding name.
Yeah, right. What a great name.
But the fact is, they had done The Room 4 months previously as an opening act for, of all things, Archie Bell and the Drells.
Tighten up.
That's right. Part one. So the band went out and they did this show and it actually was recorded. So now that show is finally being released for all the world to hear. And I want you to keep in mind, this album will contain songs that hadn't even been thought of yet, quote unquote, for recording, since they really weren't active. You know, they had songs that they had written after number one record.
Yep.
While Chris Bell was still in the group, he left. There was a division of songs that, you know, he took and took full credit for, they took and they took credit for, but were in fact a part of the Bell-Chilton axis. But, just to give you an example, at this show, they do Oh My Soul, they do Back of a Car, they do Way Out West, they do She's a Mover. These are all songs that wound up appearing on Radio City well over a year later. They also do There Was a Light, which was, in fact, a song that later came out on the posthumous Chris Bell I Am the Cosmos LP. So you're talking about some incredibly powerful moments that you can't really fathom until you hear this. But, of course, they're doing stuff like Baby's Beside Me, 13, the India song, you know, El Goodo. What can you say? You know, and I find it amusing, with my tongue firmly planted in my cheek, because I've actually read people who claim to be great fans and lovers of Big Star saying, well, isn't this just now getting to the point of scraping the bottom of the barrel, and I'm starting to tire of all this Big Star stuff. You were the same people, excuse me, who bitched and moaned about the unavailability of anything, and wouldn't it be great to hear, you know, what the original band sounded like live, because this is the lineup of Jody Stevens, Andy Hummel, and Alex Chilton.
Yeah.
You know, there's a Big Star Live record that came out on Ryko years ago, which featured John Lightman, who's an excellent bass player and Andy Hummel's replacement, but this is basically the core of Big Star. You know, not basically, this is the core of Big Star. Why would you bitch about it, you know?
Right.
And, no way, fuckheads.
And you know, rather than bitching about it, if you really don't want it, don't get it. But, you know, right. You should. Now, the other one, as we said, this out in book form, Chris Stamey of the DBs, also part of that overarching Big Star universe, explain the connection between him and Big Star.
Chris Stamey was influenced in more ways than I could probably describe by Big Star. Chris Stamey's a native of North Carolina. He and his childhood friend Mitch Easter founded bands such as The Sneakers, et cetera, et cetera. Chris Stamey left North Carolina, came up in late 77 to New York, and within 3 weeks of moving to New York, was asked if he wanted to play bass for Alex Chilton, who just moved to New York. So, of course, Chris said yes. That forged a friendship from then on, and you know, an on and off, again, working relationship. Chris Stamey, of course, founded the DBs, who were my introduction to Big Star.
Right.
But now all these years later, of course, Chris Stamey has been the director of the Big Star Third concerts ever since they were first devised as a tribute to Alex Chilton upon his death. Chris has now written a book called A Spy in the House of Loud, New York Songs and Stories. And basically, it's him telling the stories of what it was like in the late 70s, living in New York, you know, being there when New York punk was still a going concern, and, you know, punk was going from punk into new wave and no wave, and also starting the DBs. And this will be out in April, and I cannot wait, because I think the world of Chris Gainey, and certainly has had a lasting influence on me and the music I've tried to do over the years.
Well, yeah, and anybody who is a fan of the DBs or has followed Chris Damey's work knows that, I mean, there's so much storytelling that goes into the music. I'm waiting to see what that storytelling, what that raconteur ability can bring to the written word and to the page. I think it's going to be great.
I can tell you this much. If you've seen Chris Damey in interviews, he is an absolutely wonderful storyteller. You know, he makes things very warm and very, very funny. And, you know, I think the perfect definition of it is, if you've seen Nothing Can Hurt Me, the story of Big Star. But, you know, I think the perspective, I think the more interesting thing is hearing the untold stories, you know, about being in New York at that time.
Yeah.
You know, from someone who was not a native, someone who had just gotten here and was really thrown in at the deep end. It's kind of that wow factor. And you're that young and filled with so much energy and hope and creative desire and drive.
Yeah, imagine being that kid from North Carolina for your first time in the big city and being able to step into CBGB and see the Ramones.
Or stepping into CBGB the first time, strapping on a bass and playing alongside your boyhood hero.
No shit. Oh, just amazing. So yeah, again, that's coming out first part of next year, you said? March?
Yeah, April of
2018. So one to keep an eye out for, the autobiography from Chris Damey. And before we get to the In Our Head segment, there was one other piece of musical history. In fact, there's two, a father and son, that you and I are both as impressed with as we could possibly be. And I mean, being impressed with Mike Nesmith is nothing new. But for folks who still have not followed our advice and found Christian Nesmith either on Facebook, where he does a whole bunch of live songs with his girlfriend, Cersei Link, and just a tremendous amount of work that he's done, he's got music coming out. There's more about Michael Nesmith. What's going on with his family?
Well, first, let me just say this, because you bring up Christian, who's just a lovely guy and just one of the most amazing guitarists I've ever seen, because I've seen him live on a couple of occasions. He's got this new record out, and a big shout out to him, because I never got to say thank you for doing his tutorials. And when the Monkees were on tour a couple of years ago, he would, you know, have his guitar there and show you how to play certain songs and certain intros.
Yeah.
Thanks to him, I finally know how to play the opening to The Door Into Summer. So, as Christian Nesmith had said at the end of the tutorial, the more you know. Now, the wonderful news, apart from the fact that he's putting out his first new solo album in 15 years, which I think is almost criminal because his music should be out there on a regular basis, yep, is that his father, Michael Nesmith, has reformed a variation of the beloved and legendary First National Band. Now, the First National Band, for those not familiar, was Michael Nesmith's project right out of the box from when he bought out his contract with the Monkees. It was he, bass player John London, drummer John Ware, and pedal steel guitarist Orville Red Rhodes. They made three albums on RCA and broke up during the making of the third album, Nevada Fighter, which I think is probably their finest. But this was the band that he really had those solo hits with Joanne, Silver Moon, Propinquity, The Grand Ennui, his devastating version of I Fall to Pieces. Those three records are so vital and important. And to me, and this is just personal, it is Michael Nesmith's vision and the First National Band that really cemented what country rock was all about and should be and should be, you know? And he's now reformed a variation with Christian and Christian's brother, Jonathan, who's also just an amazing musician, songwriter, singer with his wonderful group, Mother of Winter, and multimedia artist, and some other wonderfully fine musicians, and they're calling themselves Michael Nesmith and the First National Band. Their shows have sold out in California. I am of the hope that it comes to New York. You know, unfortunately, both John London and Red Rhodes are both no longer with us. John Ware, who is still with us, said, if invited, he might, you know, appear for a show or two, which I think would be wonderful to see at least the last two members of the First National Band together.
Yeah.
And on the stage.
Oh, no doubt. And to see, because Michael and Christian had gone off on tour together a lot over the last few years. They would play one-off shows here and there in little bars and had such a great time Not so much as just, hey, look, it's a father and son act, but just two guys playing guitars and telling stories. And I've got a good friend who went to a number of those shows, in fact, followed them around the country for a little while as they were doing them. And he said every night was different. You know, it wasn't just, okay, let's trot this stuff out again. And all of the shows were as personal a matter as you could imagine. And the setting, being in small bars and places like that, didn't hurt. But he said that, you know, the two of them just, you got the feeling that they genuinely enjoyed not only what they were doing, but the fact that they were able to do it on stage together. So good for them. And I'm with you. I hope they do take this out wide.
Well, I don't know if we ever got to talk about, we definitely got to talk about the second show, which was the Movies of the Mind tour.
Mm-hmm.
2013, I believe it was, or maybe early 2014, but when Mr. Nesmith announced the first tour, and it was a full tour, and he played Town Hall in New York, I actually, two very important things. One, I made sure that I got orchestra seats, and I'm not kidding, I was sitting in the second row from the stage, so yeah. He was right in front of me. And two, I openly wept at that show, because that was the first show where I actually got to hear every single song that I wanted to hear and could not imagine seeing and hearing this person who I love playing those songs. You know, opening up with, I believe it was with Papa Gene's Blues, that was the only Monkey song that he offered up.
Yeah.
But the next song was Propinquity, and I just lost it. Yeah, but the fact that he did everything else, and he told wonderful stories about the songs, it was one of the most amazing, perfect, and personal moments that I think I've ever had.
Yeah, so if you get the chance, by all means, take that one and go see Mike Nesmith wherever you get the chance to do so, and if he's got Christian with him, bonus time for you. Now, it's time to get to the In Our Head segment, and this is something that, dovetailing off of what we had done on the episode 38 of the show, talking about songs that bands did that didn't sound like them. The first one that I came up with, and we talked about several more, were about the business of being a rock star and what it's like to both personally and professionally deal with the fact that you are now on everybody's radar, and how many great songs and a couple of really lousy ones too have been written in that theme. So dovetailing off of the song by the Kansas, Everybody's My Friend, which ones were in your head?
First and foremost was To Be Someone, Didn't We Have a Nice Time by The Jam, which really just spells it out in no uncertain terms.
To be someone must be a wonderful thing. A famous footballer, rock singer, or a big film star. Yes, I think I would like that.
And then that cruel, you know, bringing it full circle, I realized I should have stuck to my guns, instead shit out to be one of the bastard sons and lose myself. Yes, I know it was wrong and it cost me a lot. Now there's no more swimming in a guitar-shaped pool, no more reporters at my beck and call, no more cocaine, now it's only ground chalk, no more taxis, now we'll have to walk.
Well done, sir.
And Weller was on the cusp of 20 when he wrote that. I mean, talk about foresight. You know, really, that was just such an incredibly powerful piece of literature, and pinpointing the pitfalls of what rock stardom can be. You know, there are songs like Everybody's a Star by the Kinks, and you know, Starfucker by the Stones, and you know, there's tons of these songs.
Yeah.
But that really addresses the whole idea head on. And the other one, which is far more recent and just far more in your face and makes no bones about it, is Everybody is a Fucking Liar by the Posies.
Everyone I know is trying to get into this show. Everybody is a fucking liar. Time and time again, whoever's in the room is your friend. Everybody is a fucking liar.
I think you need to say more than that.
Yeah, right. Well, and
everyone's your friend, you know, and it's a sore spot with me, and I'll tell you why after you bring forth the songs that you would choose.
Well, there's a few of them, and you mentioned the Kinks. They wrote probably 10 songs on the subject over the years, but the one that I love the most, I think, is a song called Top of the Pops, which again is off of the Lola vs. Power Man album, because that was just such an incredible piece of work as an entirety. But that song if you've ever seen the movie That Thing You Do, that movie is about that feeling that you get when all of a sudden you write that song and it becomes, you hear it on the radio first. So, you know, somebody actually played my song on the radio. And then the whirlwind starts. And this is where Top of the Pops picks up the story. It ends. And the line from the song is, strange how people want you when your record's high, but when it drops down, they just pass you by. And it just happens is exactly that fast because there's always somebody with the next hit record behind you. So that one I love because it is as joyous as the movie, That Thing You Do was, that song has that same kind of joy to it. It's a very upbeat, very poppy number, but it ends with that, by the way, there's another side to this coin. That's my first one. I think The Stroke by Billy Squire, if you ever get the chance, there's a version of that song, because when we were kids and first heard it, we were like, he's talking about jacking off. But he isn't. That entire song is about how shitty people are when they think they can use you to make money. And the stroke that he's talking about is getting stroked by A&R guys.
Yeah.
And so there's a version of that that's on an album called 80s Hits Stripped. And it's him and a single blues guitar. And that's it. And it's really, that's an excellent song.
First you tried to bet me. You make my backbone slide. When you find your black man, skip on by. Stroke me, stroke me. Give me the business all night long. Stroke me, stroke me.
On the goofier side, go figure, would be Joe Walsh with Life's Been Good. You know, that song is also about, I'm a rock star and it's making me a little bit nuts. It's a fun song, but there's a real dark undercurrent to that song. And the one that I can't stand, just because it is what it is, and if anybody could figure out a way to take an interesting piece of subject matter like this and make it sound like a whiny bitch, it's Bob Seger's Turn the Page. I every time I see large rednecks wearing trucker hats and t-shirts with Confederate flags on them getting all weepy over Turn the Page, it makes me want to York.
You know, it's funny because there's another song that just came to mind that's it's in that bracket. And it kind of goes not just from the well, now we're successful kind of point of view, but what happens when you're in the grip of somebody controlling that success. Lynyrd Skynyrd's Working for MCA,
yes.
Which I said at all, you know, I
yep.
mean, really that song spoke volumes. That was not a pretty moment. It's a great song and it's very astute of them to write it and perform it. But, you know, oddly enough, you know, MCA definitely didn't drop them, so I have to keep on going.
I think it says something, though, that everybody who has had any degree of success, I mean, even Pink Floyd's Have a Cigar fits this category of the bullshit that you have to deal with.
I'm cutting Pink Floyd, so.
Yeah, that's fine. But yeah.
Only Solidarity or Pink Floyd, that's it. Everything else nicks.
They are right. But it's evidence again that everybody who's been around the business long enough finds the reason to write the story of it. That inspiration is there for everybody because there's always going to be that story that's going to make you as an artist wonder what the hell you're doing. Well, Spirit of Radio by Rush, same thing. that song, you know,
Tupac's Hero by Foreigner.
Right, but the plasticity of the business is laid bare in both of them. So yeah, it's something that they all get frustrated by, and yeah, giving that kind of frustration can sometimes lead to some pretty good music.
Of course, there was a song that was never officially released because no one can seem to find, you know, an audio tape that's usable, but the Monkees did their TV special, 33 Revolutions per Monkey, and there was a song that Michael Nesmith, of course, wrote and recorded for that show, which was, it was known mostly as "The Only Thing That I Believe Is True." It's also known as "The Naked Persimmon" for whatever reason, but lyrically, he talks about, you know, what was wrong with, it was really his own story. It was the Monkees' story of being puppets to Don Kirshner, you know? And I'm paraphrasing the lyrics because I've only heard the song sparingly over the years. You know, "Mr. Music Man, which way do you take your pay? Which way do you want me to walk today?"
Mm-hmm. Right. You know? Well, and
you know, there are a lot of those songs that talk about the pitfalls of stardom, the manipulation by the managers and record company people, and those who you think are your friends but just want a handout or, you know, to glom off of you in a free ride. I can honestly say that even though I have never been a quote-unquote successful musician, I have seen it happen right up close. And I speak from experience in terms of, one, you know, when you were talking about hearing your song for the first time on the radio. It happened to me, which was a more indescribably joyful moment, especially because it happened on my 22nd birthday.
Yeah.
But I think more egregiously was when I was working for a record label and I was, you know, suddenly able to go to shows and see shows and get on guest lists and get freebies and all that. And, you know, suddenly everybody wants the free drinks. And as soon as the free drinks tap is turned off when you lose that job, because as we all know, it's an industry that has eaten itself alive,
mm-hmm.
Everybody's gone. You know, everyone runs out on you, including your girlfriend of many years. Suddenly it's, you know, "You're no good to me now." Well, it's a hard road to hoe. And, you know, if you fall to the trappings of it, you get mired in the bullshit that goes along with what happens afterwards, all the cliches. Or you just do like I did and say, you know, fuck all of you. It shows who my friends are and who my friends aren't.
Yeah.
And just go on from there. So it's an ugly business. What are you going to do?
Well, I will leave you with this thought, and we'll look forward to our next get-together in the next little while. But since you brought up the Monkees once again, hey, we are the Monkees. We've said it all before. The money's in. We're made of tin. We're here to give you more.
Okay. A manufactured image with no philosophies.
Rob Ross, we'll talk to you again soon.
All right, my brother. Be well.